The final movement from Glier's Harp Concerto, played by Ossian Ellis and the London Symphony Orchestra. It's 9:28. Good day, GTA. I'm Jean Stillwell here with Mike Duncan.
13 degrees downtown. We're going up to a high of 19 today with showers beginning this afternoon and just a whole lot of rain from now till next Thursday. You've been warned. On Valentine's Day, 1989, novelist Salman Rushdie found out that a fatwa had been issued against him by the Ayatollah Khomeini for crimes against Islam. The crime? Well, his novel, The Satanic Verses. And for the ensuing decade and a bit, he had to live underground, all the while struggling to try and live a normal life, write, and fight for freedom of expression. In his new memoir, Joseph Anton, Rushdie tells us this extraordinary tale, and Salman Rushdie joins us in the studio right now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
How difficult was this to put this story to paper?
You know, strangely, it wasn't as difficult as you'd think, and I think the reason for that is that I waited a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there was a... After my life went back to normal, which was more or less in early 2002, people were urging me to write this book, you know, dangling dollar signs in front of me and so on, you know, and I just didn't want to do it. I just wanted to slam the door on those years and walk away from it, you know, and do what I always wanted to do, just to make up stories, write novels and mm-hmm. so on. And for a long time I did do that, and I just felt not ready, you know, and I just decided I'd leave it to ordinary old writerly instinct that there would come a point when the voice would say to me, okay, you're probably ready now.
Was there something that happened or clicked on that voice that said, okay, now you can
do
it?
Well, the only thing that happened was that years ago, I had given my literary archive to Emory University in Atlanta, when I say literary archive, I mean like 120 cardboard boxes full of bits of paper that were completely disorganized, you know, mm-hmm. and they spent 4 or 5 years sorting it out. And at the end of it, suddenly my whole life was neatly cataloged, you know, and there was everything had a barcode, you know, and so suddenly I could say, I need this, 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 and this, and I'd have it the next day.
Wow.
And so they did all that legwork or that very difficult work for me, which otherwise I would have had to do, you know, mm-hmm. before writing a book like this, and I suspect I'd never have done it. But once they had done that work, I thought, you know, now I actually can write this book because everything is organized for me. So that sort of let me do it.
The interesting thing about this is that you write it in the third person.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something to do with trying to write it like a novel. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've always been interested in this form of the nonfiction novel, you know, whether you, Schindler's List, you know, or The Right Stuff, or, you know, books like that. And I thought that, do it like that. I thought, use the techniques of the novel, but use it about a subject which is completely true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only difference between those books and my book is that those writers weren't writing about their own life. You know, they were writing about other people's lives. And so I thought, how do I apply that technique, but to autobiography? And the third person just helped me. It just mm-hmm. meant that I could have like one step to the right of myself and to be able to write myself like a fictional character.
It must have been, well, I mean, it comes through in the pages, the fact that even in your most private moments when you were in hiding, to hang on to yourself, because, I mean, you were even hanging around, the people you hung around the most with, your security detail, they didn't, you know, you couldn't even refer to yourself by your real name.
Yeah,
How difficult was it to cling on to Salman Rushdie?
Well, there were, not only that, but there were also, at the same time, there were people making me up, you know. There were all these various versions of Salman Rushdie walking around, you know, made up by people with whatever agenda they had, you know, and so... Yes, that question of identity became very complicated, you know, and I think one of the reasons why I always hated having this pseudonym, this Joseph Anton, which I made up from the names of Conrad and Chekhov, but I detested it. I hated having to use it. I didn't like it when the police used it to call me by that name, and I was very happy when I was finally able to kill him, you know. But I thought, I mean, the reason for making it the title of the book was just that I thought it would dramatize for people how weird that time was, you know, what a profound thing it is to be asked to give up your name.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would show people just the deep strangeness of those years.
At first, when the fatwa was issued, you tried the tactic of arguing for the novel, on an artistic merit, and you kept getting defeated by the emotional overtones that people would have. If you could time travel, would you go back and change your tactic to something else?
No. I mean, I think more so, actually. I mean, I think the thing that I came to value in these years most of all was just the, you know, the freedom of imagination, the art of the novel. I mean, the thing that I do for a living, you know, and I think I'd argue it even more vehemently now. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the great attacks against works of literature, the quality defense has always been a very important part of the defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when people defended, I don't know, Lolita or Ulysses or, you know, whatever other book was being attacked, one of the things they said is that it's a good book. And I felt sometimes, I would say to my friends when people, yes, we were all standing up for a mighty principle, you know, which is the freedom of speech. But beyond that, I would keep saying to people, would you just defend the text? You know, because the attack is very specific. The attack is on these sentences, this bit of writing, you know, and I wanted somebody to say that you're misreading it, you're getting it wrong, and actually this is a worthwhile book. And I, one of the things I'm actually happy about now at this end of the story is that finally people get to read it like a book.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And you know, they discover they like it. I mean, I was doing an event in London when the book came out there recently, and this young man stood up in the Q&A and admitted that back in the day, he'd been like 10 or 11. His parents had taken him on demonstrations against the book. And then he had grown up and read the book and discovered that he loved it. And he just stood up and made this formal apology to me in the middle of this auditorium of hundreds of people.
Yeah, how courageous.
Yeah.
It was funny because just last week I was riding the subway and I saw someone reading it on the subway. And I thought, never would have seen that.
You know, I never see anybody reading my book. People keep telling me this kind of thing. I saw somebody on the subway. I saw somebody here or there. I never see it. I think there's some absolute rule that nobody reads a book when the author's present.
It could very well be. Given everything that you've lived through and everything that you've witnessed and seen, it is a crying shame, but I think you may agree with me that if someone tried to publish a book like The Satanic Verses today, they couldn't do it.
Well, I hope couldn't do it. I think it would be harder. There's no question.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because people were scared, you know, and that's why at the end of the book, I tried to ask this question about whether what we did was a success or a failure, you know, and I think if you look at it in the kind of narrow perspective of the attack on this novel and this author, that I think we didn't do so badly. You know, I mean, the book is still around and the author's still around. Yeah. And thank goodness.
Yes, indeed.
But in the larger context of the kind of chilling effect and the fear created by this event, I think you're right. It is harder to get, not just work that's critical of Islam, but work that's even about Islam, published or broadcast anymore. And I hope that just means people have to regain their nerve, you know. And I hope there still would be some publisher, you know, who'd be brave enough to do it. But it would require bravery, which it shouldn't.
Indeed. How has this changed you both as a person and as a writer?
I mean, as a person, I don't know, because first of all, I'm much older anyway. You know, when this happened, I was 41, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a quarter of a century ago almost, you know. And I'm not that guy anymore, you know, but how much is due to this, I don't know. I think it certainly made the subject of free speech much more central to me and much more of a passionate concern because, you know, if you're lucky enough to live in these parts of the world where you, broadly speaking, have free speech, you don't need to make a song and dance about it because you've got it, you know. And it's only when somebody starts trying to turn off that tap that you become exercised by it, you know, and so that's become a big subject for me, not just my own, but in fact, nowadays, primarily other people's.
Yes.
And working on, you know, in the way that so many people stood up for me, I think maybe now it's my turn to return the compliment. As a writer, I don't think, you know, my view is that if you had never heard anything about my life and all you had in front of you was a shelf of books, I don't think you'd see that there's a great transformation around 1989. You know, I don't think you think, oh, something terrible happened to the writer there, you know. Mm. I think the books are just on their own journey, you know.
That's one of the things I was going to say that I admire.
It was a very conscious effort. I mean, I thought, I'm not going to be derailed into either writing frightened little books or angry little books.
Yeah.
You know, but don't give in to either either fear or revenge.
The temptation, you know, must have been strong.
Yeah, but, you know, I just thought that's going to destroy me.
Yeah.
And that makes me also the creature of the event, you know.
Yes.
And I thought, just try and go on being the writer you always were. And I mean, actually, that's, you know, there are things that happened in those years that I'm not particularly proud of, but that's one of the things that I am, I think. And I've just also always felt it was incredibly fortunate that I was a novelist, because novelists are used to sitting in rooms and staring out of the window and
yes.
wondering what to do. If I'd been a playwright or a film director, I think it would have been much harder to continue with my work,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to get plays put on or films financed or whatever, much harder.
Mm-hmm.
But this way, at least, I could go on being the writer I had been.
One of the other great things that comes out of this memoir, I mean, despite all the restrictions that were put on you, I mean, there's a great deal of humor in this book, and there's a great deal of just tremendous things, watching your first son grow up, the birth of your second son. I mean, these are glorious moments.
Yeah, no, but I actually think that, for me, the reason for doing the book was to tell the human story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all sort of know the political story because it was in the newspapers, etc. And whether you know a little or a lot, I mean, you know, people know what happened, sort of. Yes, there's sort of flesh to put on those bones. There's more to say about what happened. But the thing I thought, I mean, as a novelist, I'm interested in human beings and what happens to them, you know. And I know one of the great principles of literature is that, you know, crisis reveals character.
Mm.
And you take your characters and you shipwreck them, you know, and you find out what they're like,
yeah.
you know. And this was a kind of shipwreck.
Boy, was it.
You know, and it showed, I think what it did do is it revealed a lot about human nature, about the people around me. And I think it showed me how lucky I was in my friends, you know, how extraordinary they were in supporting me. And so I sometimes think what happened was that I got to witness, you know, the worst of human nature and the best,
mm-hmm.
you know, and have the two of them in collision with each other. You know? So I thought right about that.
The other fine thing that came out of this is that you finally have Midnight's children in a form that you like.
Well, I've always been... I like books, too.
I'm referring to, like, the BBC's botched attempt to...
Yes,
to
there have been one or two attempts over the years to make a movie of it, and I had sort of given up, really.
Mm.
I thought, I mean, after all, it's an old book, you know. And then Deepa Mehta and I just... Well, we had got to know each other, and we had sort of begun to talk about doing something together. And then she just, out of the blue, I think she surprised herself, actually. I don't think it was a big plan, you know. I think she just, in the course of a chat, she said, who's got the rights to Midnight's Children? And I said, well, as it happens, I do. And she said, well, can I do that? And I said, okay. And that was the negotiation, you know.
Essentially. Would that every negotiation goes so simply.
And that was here in Toronto, and I had come here for a book tour. I guess it would have been The Enchantress of Florence.
Yeah.
And that was 4.5 years ago. So I think that's not bad, actually, from zero to finished film in 4.5 years.
Mm. Well,
I'm biased because I'm involved in the film and I wrote the screenplay and so on.
And you narrated it
as well. Yeah, I think she's done a wonderful job. I mean, I think visually the film is extraordinary. I think it's so beautiful to look at. The music is extraordinary. And she's such a great director of actors that, you know, she's got these actors to give like 200%, you know, and I think it shows on the screen.
Well, I want to wish the film great success. And I want to wish you continued success. Thank you so much for writing not only this memoir, Joseph Anton, but for continuing to write and fighting for freedom of speech.
Thank you.
Been speaking to Salman Rushdie, author of Joseph Anton, a memoir. I urge you, run. Don't walk to your favorite bookstore and pick this up. No, I mean it.
No, what he said.
Exactly. It's published by Knopf Canada.